Could I ask you all to be seated? We'd like to start in a few minutes. Still plenty of seats. Why don't you try to on the sides here in the back? Well, welcome to CSIS. My name is Bob Einhorn, and this is the 29th meeting of the CSIS Smart Power Speaker Series. The series is an outgrowth of a CSIS Commission on Smart Power, which was co-chaired by Rich Armitage and Joe Nye. The commission looked at the problem of declining U.S. standing and influence around the world, and it recommended a variety of ways to reverse that decline and to turn it around with the use of what was called smart power. The final report of the commission was issued in November of last year. Today the subject is reducing the global nuclear threat, and we're very fortunate to have as our speaker Dr. William Perry. As you can see from the CV that was distributed, Dr. Perry has had a most distinguished career in public service, academia, and the private sector. In the Carter administration, he served as Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. In the Clinton administration, in its first term, he was Secretary of Defense. After leaving the Pentagon in 1997, he continued to make valuable contributions to U.S. national security policy. In President Clinton's second term, when North Korea was again making trouble and support for the administration's North Korea policy was sagging, the President called on Dr. Perry to conduct a review of the U.S. approach to North Korea. Dr. Perry conducted a thorough review, recommended a revised approach to dealing with the North Koreans, won support for it in a series of meetings with members of Congress, and launched a new and more promising phase of North Korea policy by leading a delegation of U.S. officials to Pyongyang. Earlier this year, the U.S. administration established the commission the U.S. Congress established a commission on the strategic posture of the United States and asked Dr. Perry to serve as the commission's chairman. Dr. Perry and his commission colleagues will issue their report by the spring of 2009. I can say without any risk of being contradicted that Dr. Perry is one of the most highly respected officials to have served in government in the last 30 years. And perhaps the most impressive thing I can say about him is that he's a very nice guy. Some of you may be old enough to recall that the Sara Lee cake company used to advertise by saying, "Nobody doesn't like Sara Lee." Well, nobody doesn't like Bill Perry.
That was a spectacular introduction, Bob. Although the list of all the things I have done in my life, when my wife hears an introduction like that, she says it just proves that this guy can't hold a job. Well, we do have an election coming up, and I, like many of the rest of you, have been thinking of how we could advise the new presidents coming in. I'm focusing, of course, on issues of national security. Now, both of the candidates for president have described how they plan to draw down our forces in Iraq after they are in office. And I can easily understand why this is very high on their agenda. But I must say, I do not believe that Iraq is the gravest security challenge the new president will face. Rather, I think the most serious challenges are threefold: preventing nuclear terrorism, dealing with the energy crisis, and heading off climate change before it becomes irreversible. At the end of my talk, I'll make a brief comment on the last two challenges. But my talk will really focus on what I consider the gravest immediate challenge facing the new president: stemming the cascade of proliferation now underway that could result in the terror group getting their hands on a nuclear bomb. I do not want to be an alarmist. I do not believe that there is a high probability that a terror group will succeed in getting a nuclear bomb. But I believe that the consequences would be so terrible that I still place the highest priority on preventive actions. I will say more later about why I think the consequences would be so terrible. But here I will acknowledge that my personal experiences in the Cold War have conditioned me to be especially sensitive to the dangers of nuclear weapons. I had those experiences because of an unusual turn in my life about 30 years ago. I was running a high-tech company that I had founded in Silicon Valley, and I was planning to spend the rest of my life doing just that. I had no thoughts whatsoever of going into the government. But in January 77, I got a fateful call from Harold Brown, the newly appointed Secretary of Defense, asking me to be his Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. I thought about that briefly and gave him what I thought was the appropriate answer, which was no. And a week later, after unimaginable pressure that was the wrong answer, I finally relented and agreed to do the job. At the time, friends were incredulous that I had given up my company to go back to Washington and asked me what had gotten into me. And I replied with lines from Robert Frost. He said, "I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference." I'm going to share today with you one experience that illustrates why taking that less traveled road did make such a difference in my life. One night in the summer of 1978, I was awoken at 3 in the morning by a phone call from the watch officer at the North American Air Defense Command. The general got right to the point. He said that his computers were showing 200 missiles on the way from the Soviet Union to the United States. Now, believe me, that's a waking up experience to get a phone call like that. Of course, that was a false alarm, but the general had had only 12 minutes to make that determination. He was calling me in the hopes that I might help him figure out what the hell had gone wrong so that he could explain it to the president the next morning. Well, I need not tell you that that call is engraved in my memory, but it was only one of three such personal experiences I had with false alarms. So the risks of a nuclear catastrophe were never, ever academic to me. Ironically, during that same period, I was responsible for the development of our country's nuclear weapons, including the B-2 bomber, the MX missile, the Trident submarine, the Trident missile, the air-launched cruise missile, the ground-launched cruise missile, and the sea-launched cruise missile, quite an array, nearly all of which are still operational today. But while I saw at the time the risks in building these deadly weapons, I believed it was necessary to take those risks with the threats that we faced during the Cold War. But after the Cold War ended, I believed that it was no longer necessary to take those terrible risks. And I believed that we should begin to dismantle this deadly Cold War legacy. My first opportunity to act on that belief came in 1993. I was invited by President Clinton to become the Secretary of Defense. Again, I did not want the job, and in fact, initially turned it down. But again, I finally decided to take this less traveled road. And again, it made all the difference in my life. As the Secretary of Defense, my first priority was reducing and protecting the Cold War nuclear arsenal. The greatest immediate danger was that the nuclear weapons in the hands of Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus might fall into the hands of terrorists. The tools that I had to work with at that time were the START Treaty, the Nunn-Lugar program, which had just been passed by the Congress, and the cooperation of Russia. Those were the tools. My major concern at that time was Ukraine. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine had inherited all of the nuclear weapons that were on their soil. They had, at that time, more nuclear weapons than England, France, and China combined. And the country was in social, economic, and political chaos. Through adroit diplomacy, we were able to get Ukraine to give up their nuclear weapons. Then, using the non-nuclear program, we assisted them in the dismantlement process. I personally supervised that dismantlement process, including four visits to a site called Prvomaysk, which was the premier ICBM facility in the former Soviet Union, and at that time had 700 nuclear warheads all aimed at targets in the United States. My first visit to Prvomaysk, they took me to the control center. We went down a long elevator, walked through a long passage, and met two young officers sitting at the control center. They had been told to entertain an important visitor. Well, how do you entertain an important visitor if you're... Of course, they went through a practice countdown. And as I stood there watching those young officers going through this practice countdown, looking at the maps on the wall of the United States with circles on them, I have never, ever had a more feeling of how bizarre the Cold War really was. And we left the control center, and then I observed the first removal of warheads. A year later, I was back to oversee the removal of missiles. And a year later, after that, I went along with the Russian Minister of Defense and the Ukrainian Minister of Defense, and the three of us pressed three buttons, which together, when we pressed them, blew up a silo. Now, I'm going to show you a very brief video of those three visits that was taken primarily by Russian and Ukrainian television. They've not been shown in the United States, and they were not intended for American audiences. They were intended for Russian audiences, as you will see. But it gives you some flavor of what was happening. These are archive shots of Soviet missiles, and they were Soviet then. Again, archive shots from the Soviet Union testifying. Now, these are the actual shots. That's the underground control facility. Now pay attention to this silo. You'll see it again. We were looking at it. The general was telling us, look, the warheads have been removed. And indeed they had been. Second visit, Dr. Carter and I standing in front of the SS-18, about to be removed for dismantlement. People in Ukraine were a little nervous about this. They thought we were disarming them.
That dark cloud is drifting away.
А тепер вже кінець холодній війні, і ця хмара темна, яка тоді була осіла, вже розходиться.
And we should put the same energy and skills we put to learning how to make war to learn how to make peace.
This was meant to reassure Ukrainian audiences about what was going on. Now, in the summer of in the summer of 1996, I returned to Provo for the last time. I went to the housing site we had built for the retired missile officers, where I'd met with some of the families who had just moved in. Then I went with the Russian and Ukrainian ministers to the site where the silos had previously been, and we planted sunflowers. This is one of the houses we built for the retired officers.
I told the couple who lives here about the line from Voltaire's Candide.
Я сказав сім'ї, яка тут проживає, про одну з моїх улюблених цитат із роману Candide, автор Voltaire.
The most important thing we can do in life is to cultivate our garden and to live in peace.
Найважливіше, що ми можемо вчинити в нашому житті, це є піклуватися городом і вирощувати на ньому мир.
They are cultivating their garden now and we will live in peace.
Отож, вони піклуються своїм городом і ми будемо жити.
And now the three ministers are cultivating their garden. We're planting sunflowers. This is the location where that silo had been in the first shot. And the sunflowers really did grow. In my term in office, we dismantled 10,000 missiles, and three nations, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus, that had been nuclear, went totally non-nuclear. This was the first time since the dawn of the nuclear age that the nuclear proliferation had been reversed. And I believe then, looking back to 1996, I believed we were well on our way to dealing with that problem. But that effort has stalled, and indeed it has been reversed. Russia and China are now building new nuclear weapons. The United States has never ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We did have a Moscow agreement to reduce the numbers, which is a good thing, but that agreement entails no dismantlement and no verification process. India and Pakistan have gone nuclear, and the danger of that has already been demonstrated by the actions of A.Q. Khan in selling his nuclear technology. North Korea has built and tested a nuclear weapon, and Iran is on the same path. If Iran and North Korea cannot be contained, we face a real danger of a cascade of proliferation. This is a picture, a graph, of the history of proliferation from the dawn of the age to just a few years ago. You see that rise with the ending of the Soviet Union, the dramatic dip when we succeeded in getting these three nations to give up their nuclear weapons, and then starting to move up again with the North Korea nuclear program. All of this happening, all this proliferation is happening in parallel with the emergence of catastrophic terrorism. 9/11 made real to Americans the danger of catastrophic terrorism, but a nuclear bomb in one of our cities would dwarf anything that happened in 9/11. Last year, we held a workshop here in this city called The Day After, assessing how the United States would respond to one Hiroshima-type nuclear bomb going off in one of our cities. It was an ugly story. The obvious immediate consequence was perhaps 100,000 people being killed, but the consequences went far beyond that. In our scenario, we assumed that the terrorist, after having announced credit for the bomb, would then say, by the way, I have five other bombs already planted in five other cities in the United States, and they're going to go off every month from now on, unless such and such things happen. Now, even if that were not true, can you imagine the terror it would create in those cities? They would be emptied of people. The economic, the social, the political consequences would be unimaginable. My colleague Sam Nunn has said, the world is in a race to avoid a nuclear catastrophe. But we are not racing. Indeed, we are moving backwards. In the United States, I believe the first priority of the new administration must be to get in the race and work seriously to head off this catastrophe. To be specific, how should they do that? In particular, how should they do that in the first year of a new administration? I suggest, first of all, they should awaken the world to the incredible danger of nuclear terrorism using the bully pulpit of the President, the Vice President, Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense. Secondly, besides awakening people to danger, they should take actions. Some actions can be taken near term to reduce the danger. And the near term steps that occur to me that could be taken immediately would be increasing the decision time for evaluating a missile attack so we do not have to continually face this false alarm problem. Secondly, ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, extending the provisions to START, which are about to run out next year, negotiate a new treaty on arms reduction, and support the International Atomic Energy Agency in strengthening the NPT. All of these steps could be started in the first year of a new administration. Any of them would make us safer. harder to do, but even more important, the administration must deal effectively with North Korea and Iran's nuclear weapon program. I believe that North Korea's production of plutonium and the subsequent nuclear test is the most dangerous and the most consequential foreign policy failure since the ending of the Cold War. But I also believe that it still can be resolved with diplomacy. In February, I visited North Korea to engage in some track two unofficial diplomacy that was intended to help our negotiator. That turned out to be an incredibly interesting visit. South Korea had elected a new president last year, whose inauguration was scheduled for February the 25th of this year. I had accepted an invitation to attend the inauguration. Then, to the world's surprise, North Korea invited, for God's sake, the New York Philharmonic to play in Pyongyang. Who could have guessed that? And to my surprise, I was invited by the North Korean government to attend that performance, and while there, to meet with their negotiators on the nuclear talks. The performance was set 26 February, just one day after the inauguration. So I had to say no to the North Korean government because there was no time to get there from Seoul to Pyongyang. By the way, the North Korean government insists you go, which is flying to Beijing and then flying from Beijing to Seoul. Then, to my complete surprise, the North Korean government replied that they would give me permission to cross the DMZ. And with that word, I immediately said, yes, I will go. I'm going to show you how that actually happened. This is arriving at Panmunjom, being met by our colonel there. Looking at the North Korean side, there it is. Now we're walking down to meet the North Korean colonel. Our colonel said, I've got Dr. Perry here who wants to go into North Korea. Will you accept him? And the North Korean colonel said, yes. So off we go. About this time, I was beginning to wonder. If you've never been in Pyongyang, it's a surprise to you. It's kind of a model city, show city. All the buildings are relatively new because all of the old buildings were destroyed in the Korean War. First thing we did when we got to Pyongyang was to meet with the North Korean negotiators. And here is leaving the meeting with Kim Gae-gwan and Lee Gun. Pretty flashy hotel in Pyongyang. And a really surprising concert hall, sort of comparable to the best in U.S. cities. Well, crossing the DMZ was something I will never forget. But the concert itself was even more memorable. The beautiful music was no surprise. What was a surprise was seeing the American flag on the stage and hearing the Star-Spangled Banner and seeing the North Koreans rise in attention for the Star-Spangled Banner. But the biggest surprise, truly the biggest surprise, was the standing ovation the North Koreans gave these Americans. Let me just show you that briefly. This is the CNN, some clips from the CNN coverage.
As the New York Philharmonic plays North Korea's national anthem. But who could have imagined this? The Star-Spangled Banner played in public in Pyongyang, ringing out through this concert hall and through these North Korean homes. An important political breakthrough, said one top North Korean official, since both countries are technically still at war.
Those who couldn't attend the concert could watch it on live television.
그렇게 생각해 본 적은 없었는데.
To be honest with you, I never thought that it would be possible.
But it wasn't until the encore that the ice finally melted. This is Arirang, a famous and favorite folk song for all Koreans.
Many Koreans in the audience had tears in their eyes at this point.
Separated by circumstances beyond their control. A musical metaphor, perhaps, for Korean reunification. And tonight, these North Koreans love this American gesture.
It was stunning to be there for this ovation. It started the instant the band, the orchestra, stopped playing and lasted until the last member of the orchestra left the stage. I've never seen anything like it.
It was a magic moment, I think.
Former U.S. Defense Secretary William Perry came here for the concert and to help speed up the nuclear negotiations.
Now, instead of our government talking to their government, it was the American people talking to the Korean people in a universal language of music.
I have never ever seen such an outpouring of friendship from Koreans to Americans. It was truly, as I said, a magic moment. A few senior administration officials were invited to the concert but chose not to go. I believe, and I've told them, that that was an error in judgment. This was not just a concert, any more than ping pong diplomacy in China in 1971 was about ping pong. It was an opportunity to explore the possibility of an entirely new relationship with North Korea, which, if successful, could have been to the ultimate benefit of our security. After I returned from this momentous meeting, I joined my Stanford colleague, Dr. Sig Hecker, in writing an op-ed for the Washington Post. The point of the editorial was that our negotiators should set as their first priority the disablement of Yongbyon, North Korea's facility for making plutonium. In fact, the subtitle of the article was, "It's the plutonium, stupid." We believe that it was critically important for that North Korea not make more nuclear bombs. And based on our discussions in Pyongyang, we believe that North Korea would agree to a full disablement of Yongbyon. Just last month, this phase of the negotiations was finished, and North Korea finally completed the disablement of Yongbyon. That was a major positive step, and I think our country owes a vote of thanks to a very able negotiator, Ambassador Chris Hill. But we still have a long way to go. In particular, we have not yet reached an agreement on North Korea giving up the 6 to 8 nuclear weapons that they built in the last few years. I think the key to resolving that problem is being prepared to restart work on the light water reactors, work that was stopped 5 years ago. But I doubt that the administration will do that, in which case this problem will be left as number one item for the new administration to take on. In the meantime, the nuclear weapon program in Iran moves forward, accompanied by a robust program of missile development. The Bush administration has stated that they regard an Iran nuclear program as unacceptable, but they have had no apparent success in curtailing it. And it seems clear that Israel will not sit by idly while Iran takes the final steps of becoming a nuclear power. As a result, the new administration will face a crisis with Iran, a crisis, its first year in office, maybe even its first month in office. My recommendations to the new president will be based on the following 6 judgments, which I will state as carefully as I can to you. First, the goal of the Iran nuclear program is to achieve a capability from which they could build nuclear weapons in a matter of months. Secondly, they are intent on this objective and will be not dissuaded by the present policies of weak diplomacy and empty threats. Third, if their program is allowed to reach a weapon capability, we will face a catastrophe, not the least because of the actions Israel will take if they see us unable or unwilling to act. Fourth, military action against Iran, even if successful in disabling Iran's nuclear facilities, would lead to a host of unintended consequences, some of which could be catastrophic. Fifth, a viable alternative is robust coercive diplomacy, with the coercive element being intense economic pressure. And finally, Iran is quite vulnerable to financial sanctions, so economic pressure could be effective, but only with the full participation of the European Union, Russia, and possibly China. Based on those judgments, I believe that during the transition period, the President should appoint an experienced security and economic team to formulate plans for putting global financial pressure on Iran. Then after inauguration, he should engage the European Union, Russia, and again, possibly China, to seek their cooperation on such a plan. I do not need to tell you how difficult it will be to get that cooperation. Our relations with Russia, which is key to this problem, are at an all-time low. So dealing with this problem may require the President to deal first with two major sticking points in our relations with Russia: NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine, and BMD deployment in Eastern Europe. More generally, the new President should work to build faith and confidence in America around the world. None of our major problems, nuclear proliferation, energy shortages, or climate change, can be solved unilaterally. We must build strong international programs to deal with these daunting problems. One way the President can build international confidence in American leadership is by taking a strong stand on the global dangers of nuclear weapons and by indicating that the United States will work to dramatically reduce those dangers. In January of last year, George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, and I wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed citing the danger of nuclear weapons and arguing that we should start working for the global elimination of these incredibly deadly weapons. This January, we followed up with another op-ed outlining concrete steps that could be taken the next year or two to move in that direction. Then in February this year, we met in London to rally the support of European leaders, and this fall, we will meet in India and China and Japan to rally the support of Asian leaders. Based on the responses we have gotten to date, I am encouraged to believe that we are on a positive track. Victor Hugo once wrote, "More powerful than the tread of mighty armies is an idea whose time has come." And I believe that containing the deadly Cold War nuclear legacy is an idea whose time has finally come. The new President can also build faith in America by moving decisively to deal with the twin crises of energy and environment. That is another talk for another day. But I just came from a Stanford conference on energy and environment, so I'm inspired to end my talk with a few brief observations on those two critical problems. There's been some very important progress in technology in these past few years. It is likely that plug-in hybrids that get more than 100 miles per gallon will be available in a year or two. And all electric cars are only a few years behind them. As these new cars move into mass production, it will dramatically reduce the oil used in transportation. But it will also increase the demand for electricity. Fortunately, at the same time frame, substantial improvements are being made in solar energy. It seems likely that solar energy will reach grid parity, that is, be cost competitive with other sources for grid electricity, within 5 years. And that will open up a vast supply of non-carbon energy. The power from the sun is virtually unlimited. The sand to make the silicon in solar arrays is virtually unlimited. And there's ample space in our deserts to locate the solar arrays. Finally, very promising technical progress is being made in designing buildings that conserve energy. In fact, California is mandating that new buildings be net zero energy by the year 2020. Well, these are just a few examples of the exciting long-term work underway to meet the daunting challenges that we face. America's technology has always risen to our greatest challenges and is doing so again in meeting the energy and environmental challenges. That is the good news. The bad news is that our political progress has not equaled our technology progress. The new president will be faced with the challenge of inspiring our body politics to be as good as our technology. Some have talked of tackling the energy and environmental problem with the new man to the moon type challenge. And I agree. I believe that we could set a truly dramatic goal, for example, in 10 years, cutting in half the oil that we import. But while such a dramatic result would deal with our national energy problem, it would not have the needed effect on global climate change unless it led to comparable results in other nations. Climate change is truly a global problem. China, for example, is already competitive with the United States in CO2 emissions. So the urgent task, I conclude with this, the urgent task of our new president will be to put our nation on a responsible course in energy and environment, and then by our example to lead the rest of the world in this direction. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Perry has agreed to take questions, interested in hearing your comments as well. We're going to go until 5:30. We're going to stop promptly then. Those of you in the back, there are a number of seats up in front, in the middle. Please, take the seats if you'd like. I will recognize you, and please wait for the microphone and speak into it clearly, and please make your questions or comments short. I'd like to start off with a couple of questions, Bill. One is on North Korea, and that is, do you believe that the leadership in Pyongyang is genuinely prepared to eliminate its nuclear weapons capability completely? What do you think their objective is? Second question has to do with your remark about Russia, which I completely agree with, which is to say that if we're to solve some of these difficult proliferation problems, we're going to need the cooperation of Russia. And you mentioned that's going to involve our addressing two problems. And you mentioned there missile defense components in Eastern Europe and the question of NATO membership, primarily for Ukraine and Georgia. So first question, North Korea, what's their goal? Are they prepared to give up their nuclear capability? And the second, how could we address those two issues, missile defense in Eastern Europe and NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine, in a way that could get Russians to be more cooperative in dealing with Iran and other proliferation challenges?
On the first question, Bob, I do believe that North Korea is prepared to give up their nuclear weapon, seriously. I can't be sure what price we'll have to pay to do that. My own judgment is that the price of two light water reactors, which we started to build and then terminated a few years ago. And I, for one, would be willing to pay that price. I think more importantly than what I believe is that I think it's crucial that we put to a test whether that is correct. And I think we can do that if not in the waning months of this administration, then I think in the early months of the next administration. It's absolutely critical that we put that to a test. And I think we can do that. It does not require great imagination as to what has to be done to achieve that. If I'm right, then we will have gained a very important security benefit by having stopped that program. If we do not stop that program, if we don't reverse that program, it seems to be very unlikely we'll be able to deal with the Iranian program. And this cascade of proliferation I was talking about, I think high probability will follow from that. So this is the first and most critical step. And it seems to me two light water reactors is a very small price to pay for that, particularly since North Korea and Japan are paying the bills for two light water reactors. They've already paid a big part of those bills.
on the question of Russia, I cited the need for having Russia's cooperation in Iran, but that's just one of the many areas that we need Russian cooperation today. I admit to very great disappointment in Russia's slide away from democracy. I don't think there's much that the United States can do about that, except deplore it. But whether or not they are a democratic country, we still need their cooperation. And we need it desperately in several areas, including the one of Iran. The two specific issues that I talked about, that's not a unique set of problems we need to deal with, but those are two that are sort of number one and two on their list we need to deal with. Let me take, first of all, the national missile defense deployment in Eastern Europe. I would want to take the Russians at face value when they say they're willing to consider a cooperative program. And indeed, basing these systems in Russia, if that indeed could be negotiated, would give us a far better access to the Iranian missile trajectories anyway. So I would, I cannot tell you as I sit here that that negotiation would succeed. But I would start off in dealing with Russia by saying, all right, you have proposed a cooperative program, we agree, now let's talk about some of the world would be. And it would be more than just a radar based in Russia, it would be a serious cooperative program. They have to be at least as much concerned about Iranian nuclear missiles as we are. So there's a basis, I think, for discussion and negotiation there. On the NATO enlargement question, I just believe that we should stop promoting Ukraine and Georgian access to NATO. That's different from saying that it should be denied, but I think we should start promoting that for openers. Those two steps alone, I think, would give us a basis for rebuilding an effective negotiating posture with Russia again. And I think it's very, very important to us. What is at stake here is much bigger than those two issues, I think.
Thank you. Can you pick up Dr. Perry's mic? Is that what you're...
Is that better?
Yeah, much, much better. Okay, Arno? Here's the mic coming.
Mr. Secretary, Senator Nunn told us that it would be an absolute miracle if Russian nuclear materials had not found their way out of Russia since the beginning of the Nunn-Lugar legislation. Do you share that view? And if you do, does that mean that we have to assume that these nuclear materials are already in the hands of Islamist extremists?
I do not have 100% confident answer to that question. It's a very important question. But I have looked at that question. I have discussed in this and sought information on it from everybody I could get, everybody who I thought might know. My best judgment today is that a significant amount of fissile material has not gotten out of Russia. Not enough to make a nuclear bomb. I do know that small amounts, grams, have gotten out, but I do not think the necessary tens of kilograms have gotten out. I could be wrong on that judgment, but a lot of people are looking, trying to answer that question. And, so the opinion that they give me is not an offhand opinion. And I think probably we can be relatively confident on that point. I would go along with Senator Nunn's statement and add to it by saying, if that is correct, if my judgment is correct, that it's something of a miracle. We worked hard to try to prevent that from happening, but even so, the problems, as we looked at it back in 1993-94, seemed daunting indeed. And in 93 or 94, I would have predicted that some substantial amount would have gotten out by now. So if it is not, it's been a combination of good management and good luck.
Yes, over here. Please wait for the microphone and then identify yourself.
Uh, My name's Howard Moreland. As I understand it, I don't know if you count Pakistan as being in the Middle East, but the only nuclear weapons in the Middle East now are American nuclear weapons in Turkey and Israeli nuclear weapons. It seems to me that that has to be mentioned whenever you're talking about Iranian potential nuclear weapons. The United States could eliminate its own nuclear weapons in Turkey, and I think Israel is dependent enough on the United States that the United States could simply tell Israel to lose the nukes, and we'd have a nuclear-free Middle East. As long as Iran, I think, is surrounded with weapons, with nuclear nations with nuclear weapons, there's going to be a strong incentive for them to try to join the club.
Yeah, I understand the premise of the question very well. There's no doubt that Iran has incentive to build nuclear weapons, the ones you mentioned and others as well. But nevertheless, the danger of getting nuclear weapons, I think, far is substantial enough that we have to find ways of preventing it. One way of trying to find ways of preventing it would be to try to reduce some of those incentives they have to build nuclear weapons. I'm not sure we can achieve that. We have little or no control over Israeli nuclear weapons. We certainly have control of our nuclear weapons in Turkey and could pull them out. I would not want to recommend that without very careful consultation with NATO and with Turkey and considering what the consequences of doing that would be. One possible consequence is in providing incentive for Turkey to move toward the nuclear weapon program, which would be a wrong conclusion. So to the extent we move in that direction, I'm saying we should be doing very, very carefully with considering the unintended consequences beside the consequences we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. Right here, microphone. Fellow in the blue shirt.
James Kitfield from National Journal Magazine. Dr. Perry, you talked about this next administration perhaps in a matter of months facing a crisis about Iran and its nuclear weapons. You were inside during a similar crisis in 1994 with North Korea's nuclear weapons. I think I've heard you say that it was very close to war and that maybe your decision was, and I want you to remind us, that rather than allow North Korea to get nuclear weapons at that time, you would have supported an American strike. Could you talk about, having gone through that kind of crisis inside administration, what lessons you would pass along to this next administration that might confront that awful choice in its first months?
Well, in North Korea then, as in Iran today, the option of a military strike was available and was considered. And in Iran today, as in North Korea then, we understood that the price of such a strike would be very, very high. And while we had taken the necessary preparations for conducting such a strike, we had all of our energies put forward on trying to find a diplomatic solution to the problem. I believe today, the lesson then is we should be applying the same really high-energy diplomatic approach to resolving the problem in Iran. The difference today is that the diplomatic solution in Iran, I believe, does involve intense cooperation with the European Union and with Russia. That's what makes it so difficult. I do not think a non-military solution to Iran, economic and financial pressure on Iran, which is the key to coercive diplomacy, can be done effectively by the United States alone or even by the United States and European Union alone. And while I think it's a daunting task to get that cooperation, I also observe that the United States, Russia, and the European Union have the same goal, have the same interest in this, and therefore it should be possible to craft a way of doing that.
Do
David Berto with CSIS. Dr. Perry, we're almost 15 years now into the collective programs that you referred to as non-Luger in your talk. I wonder if you might comment on the pace of progress under non-Luger and whether it has met the expectations that were envisioned at its initiation, and whether you might also comment as to the degree to which a reinvigoration or an expansion of non-Luger might earn a place on your list of near-term steps that the administration might take.
Thank you, David, for that question. I'm happy to answer it. The last question, yes, it should be on the list. What was on my list, though, is a new arms treaty for reduction. And that's a precondition to have a new condition. I mean, that's a condition that's necessary in order to be able to move ahead with the non-Luger. There have to be more, there have to be an agreement to reduce these weapons in the first place. What's also necessary, which I did not mention in any detail, is the cooperation we got from Russia in executing the non-Luger, but we would need that again. I have a hard time imagining getting that cooperation from Russia today. So it gets back to the fact that one of the goals of the new president would be somehow establishing a working relation, a working diplomatic relation with Russia again, so that we can work together in areas where where our cooperation achieves results which are mutually beneficial. And those are a very important set of problems. That we're going to have many areas where we are opposed to each other in the results we want. But the areas in which we have common goals are so important that we need to be working together to achieve those.
And you. Microphone, right? Stand up, Ann, sorry.
Ann Harrington. Dr. Perry, I'd like to ask a follow-up, actually, to that last question. On the issue of a new arms reduction treaty, would you see that actually as being only between the United States and Russia, or a broader instrument? And similarly, since Congress has now lifted the geographic limitation on the non-Luger program, and the G8 has just announced an expansion or intended expansion of the global partnership, what role could those play in addressing these much broader issues? Thank you.
I think the next agreement, arms reduction agreement with Russia, would be with Russia alone. The one after that, as we start to get to lower levels, would necessarily involve other nations. With that agreement for the further reduction, then there's going to be the need for further dismantlement. I would imagine it's going to proceed differently than non-Lugar programs have in the past. One of the reasons we had the non-Lugar program was because Russia could not afford to do the dismantlement that was entailed in their program. Now they can. So there's a different set of conditions now. So I would imagine we would be proceeding differently in the future. But what would remain the same is the necessity for cooperating in making this dismantlement and making it as rapid as we can. Between the START agreement and this new agreement I'm talking about, we have the Moscow agreement. The Moscow agreement does not, however, call for dismantlement of any weapons. And both the United States and Russia can meet the terms of the Moscow agreement simply by moving nuclear weapons from deployed status to storage status. That, to me, is not a satisfactory solution to the answer to why I'm looking for another agreement beyond that. Also, the Moscow agreement has no verification procedure, and I do believe we need to have the kind of verification which was originally agreed to in the START Treaty to be extended. One of the main reasons for extending the START Treaty, which is going to expire this year, is to keep alive the verification procedures, which were very carefully worked out and which turned out to be quite effective.
Harlan Ullman, CSIS. Thank you for your presentation. My question has to do with Iran. Supposing our efforts fail, Iran develops nuclear weapons and capable launching systems. What's your plan B?
Ask the question again. I haven't quite followed.
If Iran develops nuclear weapons and launching systems, so they actually have a deployable, usable nuclear capacity, what's plan B?
I have a hard time imagining that outcome. The reason I do is because even if we sit by and do nothing, as I said in my talk, I do not imagine Israel sitting by. So I see something happening that's going to interrupt that process so it doesn't get to that stage. And because I believe that something is going to happen, and because I believe the consequences of that, unintended consequences, are going to be profound, I think we have a huge imperative to try to keep that from happening. And that huge imperative, I think, is very aggressive, robust, coercive diplomacy. I will take the theoretical question one step farther, though. If I did imagine a nuclear Iran, do I think that problem is dangerous enough to warrant a consideration of military action? And my answer to that would be yes. That was my answer in the case of Korea in 1994. It would be my answer in Iran today.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Celia Durkin. You outlined strategies for eliciting Russian cooperation, but I was wondering if you had any strategies to elicit Chinese cooperation.
The answer to that is yes, and I'll talk about it, but I want to distinguish it. To the extent I was talking about Iran, I think the Chinese cooperation is not as critical there. It would be helpful if China were not interfering in that process. What we need from China is a passive role in Iran. What we need from Russia, though, is an active role. So I want to discriminate between the need for cooperation between China and Iran in the case of Iran. Now, more generally, the looming problem with China in the future, I think, may very well be competition in the energy field. But at the same time, that opens the possibility of cooperation in the energy field. I was in China just 2 weeks ago, and in Taiwan 2 weeks ago. And while there, I had fairly extensive meetings with the leaders in their solar energy industry, looking for ways of whether we could find ways of cooperating in that field. The answer is there are many, many technical arguments for the three countries cooperating in this field and accelerating the emergence of solar energy is a powerful factor in all three of our countries. So I mentioned briefly the developments in improved efficiency buildings. The country that's building the most buildings in the world today is China. And all of them are being built to efficiency standards much less than the relatively inefficient buildings in the United States today. So there's real cherry picking available there. We can make huge improvements in efficiency and the conservation of energy by simply building the new buildings that are being built to modern standards. The United States is the world's leader in how to do that, and we could provide, it would be to our benefit as well as the Chinese benefit to cooperate in that field. So there's a long list of programs not related to the security field in which we can and should be, not directly related to the security field, which we can and should be cooperating with China. Peter.
Peter Sharfman, Miner Corporation. You spoke of some specific actions that could and should be taken promptly to deal with North Korean threat and Iranian threat. What actions above and beyond what is already being done would be appropriate to further diminish the threat of terrorist use of nuclear weapons?
I have very low confidence that if a terror group gets its hands on nuclear weapons, that we can stop that terror group from getting it into the United States and detonating it. Therefore, all of our attention, or 90% of our attention, should be focused on what we can do to prevent them from getting the nuclear weapon. And I would add to that, getting them from getting the fissile material from which they might be able to make a nuclear weapon. So the steps that I laid out for preventing nuclear proliferation turn out to be the most important thing we can do to keep a terrorist from getting a nuclear weapon. I talked about preventing the proliferation of Iran and reversing the proliferation of North Korea. I did not mention Pakistan. But those are the three countries from which I would be most concerned about nuclear weapon and fissile material coming from. Dealing with the problem of nuclear material or nuclear weapon out of Pakistan is a very difficult problem. Pakistan is a friendly country. We have friendly relations with them. So what we need from Pakistan, what I'm sure we're trying to get today, is cooperation from them in that field to help prevent the leakage of nuclear material from Pakistan. The reason I think we have substantial reason to be concerned about that, given the history with the AQ Khan network. And while AQ Khan is now under house arrest, I'm not sure that his network has been totally closed down. So that's the kind of those are the kind of worries I would have. But the immediate problem is stopping the proliferation. It's already, as I said, underway. Yeah. George.
George Moose.
Excuse me. Let me just add one other thing to Peter's question. I should. Beyond the things we can do to try to keep fissile material and nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists, there are a whole set of actions already underway trying to break up terror groups in general. Obviously, those are useful steps in that direction as well.
George Moose, Dr. Perry, you spoke about strengthening our support for IAEA in its enforcement of the NPT, but you didn't speak about the NPT itself, which I think most have recognized as a fundamental flaw. Where does that figure in your constellation of actions, near-term, long-term? And a related question, which is, we've had a very different approach to India and its nuclear program over the last several years, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about the value, the validity of that kind of an approach versus trying to return to some universal set of standards with regard to nuclear programs.
The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, is the basis on which we need to be working to prevent proliferation in the world. It is an imperfect treaty, but it's the best treaty we have, and it's the best treaty we're going to get. And therefore, rather than trashing the NPT or complaining about it, we need to see what we can do to make it work more effectively. The IAEA and several different countries have proposed measures that could strengthen the enforcement mechanism of the NPT without going back to completely renegotiating the treaty, and I support. I have no particular favorite among the various proposals that are being made. Any one of them would be a huge improvement over what we have now, but the whole point of the improvements would be to get the nuclear fuel cycle under control. And if we can do that, the NPT is the appropriate vehicle, again, for enforcing that change. But the weakness in the NPT today is that when it was crafted many years ago, people did not envision, I think, adequately the problem of nations taking advantage of the NPT to get right up to the threshold of nuclear weapons and then withdrawn from the NPT and go nuclear, as North Korea did and as we fear Iran might do. And now that we understand that problem, there are obvious ways of dealing with the problem, and they can be done within the treaty, but they do involve nations agreeing to the extra constraints put on them. So far, that's been a very tough sell. And I'm not sure I have any infinite wisdom on how to make that happen. I mean, I see the way to what needs to be done, but I'm not sure politically how to make it happen. But I'm convinced that the way to do it is through the NPT and not independent of it. That was one question. The other question was
India.
Pardon?
India.
India. I do not believe that the present agreement between the American government and the Indian government on nuclear weapons is going to hold. But I think it had the right intention of trying to get cooperation with India in this field of nuclear weapons, of nuclear power. And therefore, I think the new administration will have to find some other way of doing that, of achieving a basis of cooperating and working with India in this field. But I can't describe what that different way is going to be, but I do not think it's going to be the agreement that was made this past year.
stand up so you can see where to take the microphone.
Thank you. I'm Martin Schramm, a columnist with Scripps Howard. Let me approach the Iran question from another end. What is it in the way of actions, perhaps bold actions, that you think might be most persuasive to the Iranian decision-making powers, actions that could be taken by the United States, Europe, even Russia together, that might persuade them to abandon their nuclear intentions?
What I cited in my talk more generally was financial economic pressure. To be more specific, I think it would be putting their banking system out of business. And I think that could be done. And I think it would inflict great pain on Iran. Whether it would cause them to take the necessary action remains to be seen. But that's certainly the step that I would propose taking. It cannot be done unilaterally by the United States.
Steve?
Thank you. Steve Flanagan from CSIS. Dr. Perry, you and your fellow advocates of nuclear elimination have identified a fairly robust agenda on arms control and confidence building with the Russians in the out years. You mentioned a few of the things, the START 1 extension, moving on to Moscow treaty, a range of confidence building and stabilization measures. And I wondered, as you look out at if you were advising the next president, where you would want to prioritize those, and particularly now as you look at this new framework that's been established at Sochi for renewing the discussions of strategic stability with the Russians and where you would put your priorities. And secondly, with regard to particularly any discussion, U.S.-Russian discussion of cooperative development of defenses, strategic missile defenses, how would you approach the Chinese on that question to ensure that that doesn't instill some kind of a countering offensive race on the part of the Chinese?
Will you ask that second question again? I didn't quite get that.
How would you engage China, particularly as the U.S. and Russia move forward on discussions of strategic stability and cooperative development of missile defenses, how would you engage the Chinese, and particularly to head off any kind of countering offensive buildup on their part?
This group asks tough questions here.
They do.
I don't have the answer to those two questions. I'll give you just some thoughts about them. I don't know the best way of approaching the Russians and how to prioritize the various things we need to do with the Russians. I'm not well informed and smart enough to lay that pattern out for you, but I am absolutely persuaded that we have to get on a good working relationship with Russia again. The two areas that I can clearly identify are the National Missile Defense deployment in Eastern Europe and the NATO enlargement, and I could describe a course of action on dealing with those two problems. But those are not the only two problems we have with Russia by any means. I do believe, though, that if we could solve those two problems, it would clear the air and create a much better environment for dealing with the other problem we have with Russia. Now, on China, we have tried for many years to get a strategic dialogue going with China. There's a dialogue about strategic systems, as we have had for Russia for a good many years. But it's been largely unsuccessful. I tried it when I was the Secretary of Defense, and it was rebuffed. Bill Cohen tried it when he was Secretary of Defense and rebuffed. I do think the Chinese are beginning to change their views on that. And my last visit to China was just a few weeks ago. We did talk, now in a track too, on an official basis, we did talk about nuclear and strategic issues. And for the first time, I saw a willingness on the part of China to discuss and engage these issues. So I would recommend the new administration make it a high priority to make an initiative to the Chinese sit down for a serious dialogue on strategic issues. I think maybe the time has come when that can happen. And I would certainly want to make a serious approach, a test of that theory. There is no reason why we cannot be discussing with them issues like how missile defense affects strategic forces, seek a little more transparency from them about what they're doing, what they're planning to do on their strategic forces. The last thing we want to happen and the last thing they need to happen is some kind of an arms race getting underway between the United States and China based on a misunderstanding of what each side is intending to do or planning to do. That could happen. And one way of minimizing the chance of that happening is to get some sort of an intelligent dialogue going between our two countries. And I think the time is right for maybe doing that.
And let me follow Steve's question. I mean, one of the hardest strategic issues I think the next administration will face is what kind of a strategic relationship do we want with China? We have told the Russians that our missile defense program is not designed to nullify their strategic deterrent, not designed to deny them a retaliatory capability. In part, we say that because we can't imagine that we could ever technically achieve that kind of capability. But with China, the situation is different. They have a much smaller strategic force, and we might aspire to achieve a missile defense capability that could nullify their deterrent. But an issue, I think, confronting the next administration is whether it should be U.S. policy to strive for that kind of strategic dominance, to be able to impede China acquiring a secure second strike capability, or whether we should basically acquiesce to the reality that given their economic strength and the technological prowess, they're going to achieve that anyway. Could you comment on that?
In general, I do not think it's good for either the United States or China to get into an arms race. And I believe we are in danger of that happening, particularly in the nuclear field. And it's a no-win situation for both countries. One way of dealing with that problem is the strategic dialogue that I was talking about earlier. But I think we should be prepared to look at our national missile defense system that's deployed in Alaska, to look at how it appears to the Chinese. And if it has a serious capability of stopping their second strike deterrent, we should realize they're not going to accept that. And therefore, that's going to lead to that kind of an arms race. It's a long-winded answer. I guess the short answer to the question is I'm very doubtful that this national missile defense system in Alaska is in the United States' best security interest. That's the short answer.
Yes, sir. Stand up.
My name is Bishop O'Dell. Sir, with the changing dynamics of geopolitics, Arctic meltdown, and environmental degradation, financial dislocation, economic problems all around the world, shouldn't the next president be advised to put U.S. House in order, being less diplomatically, strategically, and defense aggressive around the world, so that U.S. will start commanding the respect and care that the world has bestowed on the Jeffersonian, Lincoln, and all these great values for which this country stands? Wouldn't that be your best advice to the next president of the United States? What is your opinion, sir?
The short answer to that question is I think the United States, to achieve its national security objectives, needs international cooperation and respect. And I think we not only should strive to get that respect, I think we should deserve the respect.
Thank you. Yes.
Good Thank you, Secretary Perry. Nadia Chow with Liberty Time from Taiwan. Since you just mentioned you've been to Taiwan and China not long ago, I wonder that President Ma seems to send you a very strong message that Taiwan still wants to purchase arms, you know, weapons from U.S. and while maintaining a good relationship with China. I wonder, you know, but people here in Washington seems to have a different opinion. We understand that some of the important arms sales has been held by Bush administration. So wonder that from your point of view, do you think Ma, what kind of message does, you know, President Ma send to you? And for the next administration, do you think the arms sales and the current defense cooperation with Taiwan should continue? Thanks.
Let me make two comments about that. I have been following Taiwan-China cross-strait relationships carefully for many, many years, including the time I was required to dispatch two carrier battle groups to Taiwan. So this is an issue which I think a lot about. From the United States point of view, the big danger of a cross-strait crisis is that it could escalate into a military conflict, which in turn would drag the United States into a war with China, which we don't need, and they don't need, and the world doesn't need. So I've been worried for many, many years that a cross-strait crisis could erupt into a military conflict. After my visit to Taiwan and China a few weeks ago, where I had a chance to make a very careful assessment of the present situation there, I am my concern about that problem is at an all-time new low level. That is, I'm much more optimistic now than I've been for many, many years. As it stands today, I think it's very unlikely there will be any kind of a military conflict across straits in the foreseeable future. And I would not have said that any time in the last 10 years, so I think there's been a huge improvement. Now, against that basis, we see both President Ma and the Chinese government beginning to work together on areas that they wouldn't even talk about over the last 10 years. Small but very important progress been made, for example, across strait flights. And the important thing is that the trend is in exactly the right direction. So I'm very hopeful and very optimistic that whole problem is going to be diffused. The question on arms sales is whether President Ma asking for the arms sales to go through at this time, whether that will substantially and maybe even irreversibly stop the progress that's been made with China. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do believe that if President Ma asks the administration to follow through on the offer we made some years ago, that we are really obliged to do that. So if that request comes in firmly, we want to proceed with the offer that you made us a few years ago, then I think the administration would feel obliged, I think, to respond positively to that. But the question is to whether that is the wisest move for President Ma to make right now, but that's his decision to make, and we should be honored if he makes it.
Andrew.
Andrew Pierre from Georgetown University. Mr. Secretary, in your response to an earlier question regarding missile defense in Europe, you indicated one way to deal with this issue would be cooperatively with Russia. But I'd like you to ask you to step back one step and address the question as to whether missile defense in Europe is a good idea at all. Interestingly enough, in Poland and Czechoslovakia, in the public and in the parliament to some extent, it doesn't have much support. I don't get a sense that in the EU as a whole, the notion of they're being defended somehow in this way has a great deal of enthusiasm, if I can put it that way, or desire to participate themselves, except for those two countries. And you pointed out earlier that we wouldn't, in your judgment, even permit the Iranians to develop a real capability, or that we would let the Israelis take care of that problem. And also it raises two other questions. One is of if we support missile defense over there, why not someplace else, be it in the Middle East or other parts of Europe or elsewhere? And finally, is it going to work? Because there are some people, such as Dick Garwin, who have deep doubts about his technical feasibility, and I'm sure you are in a position to have some views on that. So I'm really raising the question of whether this initiative of the administration was a good idea to start with.
I've been trying to avoid that question a lot. But you've confronted me with it in such a way that I cannot avoid it any longer. I am a strong supporter of tactical and theater missile defense systems designed against conventional missiles, conventional armored being fired against our troops or deployed areas. I think they have good cost-effective relations. I am not now, and I won't, have never been, a supporter of national missile defense systems against nuclear armed attacks. So I didn't support the deployment in Europe in the first place. I didn't support, for that matter, the deployment in Alaska for the same reason. To the extent we are concerned with Korean nuclear missiles and Iranian nuclear missiles, I think the last line of defense, and not a very effective line of defense, is building missile defense systems for them. We should be striving. Our whole policy should be oriented around preventing that from happening in the first place. To the extent it does happen, as it has happened, for example, to a small number of missiles in Korea right now, deterrence still works with nation states. My principal concern about nuclear weapons threat to the United States today is not nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles being fired at us, but nuclear weapons in the hands of a terrorist who would deliver them with a truck or a freighter, not with a ballistic missile. So I think it's the wrong emphasis. In the military value of a national missile defense system, I do not give it zero. I give it some value. But then when I place that value on all the other things I want to do in defense, it never made my cut as being worth $10 billion a year or whatever it's going to cost to do it. So I don't want to say it's zero value. I just think it's a low enough value that I would not have it in my defense budget if I was submitting it.
We only have time for a couple more questions. One here, Jim.
Thank you very much. I am Jim Scheer from the National Defense University. Good to see you, Mr. Secretary. A question about nuclear terrorism, which you've just mentioned again. If it becomes technically possible at some point in the future for the United States to attribute a nuclear explosion back to its fissile source, would it be in the interests of a future U.S. administration to, in some way, even on preventive grounds, to hold that source country responsible in some fashion?
I think, Jim, the answer is in some fashion, yes, but I'm not sure what the fashion is. If a nuclear bomb goes off in San Francisco and we do a detailed forensic analysis and discover it came from Russia, what now? We can two clear alternative different courses of action. One of them is take some sort of retaliation action against Russia. Presumably, Russia didn't do that deliberately. It happened because of neglect on their part, but it happened. So are we going to fire a missile at Moscow? I don't think so. In fact, what we will want at that stage, I would imagine, is the fullest cooperation with Russia to track down what happened in case there's another two or three or four or five missiles somewhere. So what we will be wanting at that stage is cooperation, not retaliation. So I have supported and in favor of good forensics capabilities. It's very difficult to do, and as it's present state of the art, it's not something we do with 100% confidence. But assuming we can do it, and I think it's good, then the response to it is not the response most people are thinking about or talking about. It's using that information to try to work cooperatively with the country who let the material get out, to try to deal with second or third or fourth when it might happen. when the first one goes off, that's already happened, but that you still have to worry about another two or three or four missiles, two or three or four weapons that may be available. And to get that answer, we need cooperation of the countries from which it came.
Final question.
Hi, Dr. Perry. My name is Laura Tom. I am a CSAC student at Stanford, and I'm also with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. I was just wondering, given that you said earlier that you think that the U.S.-India deal had the right intentions, I was wondering what you think the next president should do or hope to aspire in terms of relations with Pakistan, which is also a country that has not signed the NPT, and what you think this says about the integrity of the NPT and whether we are moving in direction of a international regime outside of the NPT.
A big and important question of which I can only offer some partial comments. One thing we could and should be doing with both India and Pakistan is working with them on devices which protect nuclear weapons from unauthorized use. That's a danger with both countries. We are probably have the gold standard in how to do that. We should be willing to share that technology for their benefit and for our benefit. Another thing we should be trying to do is get them to take the kind of actions in support of nonproliferation that they would take if they were members of the nonproliferation treaty. So it might not be, for a variety of reasons, it might not be politically feasible to get them in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but we ought to try to get a virtual membership in the treaty and get the benefits of that. Those are the only two suggestions I have as to how we could deal with that problem. My greatest concern, actually, in the case of Pakistan, is the unauthorized release of some of the material or some of the weapons. And so finding a way to work cooperatively with that government to deal with that problem is a very high priority. That doesn't come into quite the same category, but in some ways it's even more important. Thank you. It's great to talk to you today.
Thank you.